If there any good came from a massive killing of bees in northern Oregon last year, it was that the killing focused attention on the animals that died. We've gotten to know bees and what they do a whole lot better since that time, and we're applying the term pollinator to them a lot more often. That is one of the major functions of bees. They are remarkable creatures, and today's guest can certainly attest to that. John Jacob is the president of Southern Oregon Beekeepers, and we can spend this hour picking his brain for information about bees and what they do, humans and what they do on behalf of bees, and efforts to breed bees that are better able to survive what humans and nature do to them. John, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us first about what attracts somebody to be a beekeeper in the first place. Is this a full-time job for you?
It is. It's about 6 or 7 months of the year. It's substantially more than full-time. But when you really love what you do, 7 days a week is no problem.
So what do you do 7 days a week then?
Well, it really starts in January as we get the bees ready to pollinate almonds in central California. We pollinate down around Modesto all the way up to Chico. And there's quite a bit that goes into having a hive ready to pollinate crop by February 7th. It's still technically winter, so there's a little bit of finesse and art getting bees that are populous enough to do the job that early in the year.
You know the procedures so well now. Let's bring people back in on square one, though. I mean, for example, when you first started doing what you're doing with bees, how did you get into the business?
I was actually studying the culture of other beneficial insects for pest control, and the startup to get into that seemed unobtainable for a college kid at that time. Happened across a used bee book and realized, wow, I have $500 and I can be in the game tomorrow. And once I got my first couple hives going, it's almost like an affliction. It gets in your blood and you just love bees. I mean, even if I didn't make my career from bees, I will always have bees. I mean, it becomes a part of you. It's a lifestyle, really.
What did that first $500 get you?
Well, I started off with a 1 3-pound package of bees. Then I got an observation hive, and I'm not sure what I totally spent that year, but I ended up with 5 or 6 hives my first year.
So a 3-pound package, I mean, how did this arrive?
I went up to Portland and picked it up and brought it down here myself, and took me over an hour to install it because I was terrified. I had no mentors, and you know, now we can do 400 or 500 of those in 4 or 5 hours. You know, things have changed a lot over the last 20 years.
So the bees went where? I mean, what sorts of structures did you have to build or provide or put together for them?
There's a lot of standardized beekeeping equipment out there, and I just started with that, and you basically take the queen out and dump the bees in and feed them, and you're off to the races from there.
All right. So they come with, all the basic elements are there, the queen and the workers and all that?
A package just comes with a queen and adult worker bees. I encourage a lot of people who are interested in getting into bees to, instead of a package, get what's called a nucleus colony. And instead of just having the queen and all adults, you'll have the queen, adults, and all stages of eggs, larva, and pupa. So they're a little more stable and more forgiving for the beginner.
All right. And you mentioned being terrified when you first got the bees out. I mean, was your terror justified, or were you fairly deft in handling them?
It was totally silly. I mean, once you realize that bee venom's actually good for you, and you actually do develop quite a bit of a tolerance to it over time. And you know, having read one really old book and had no mentors, I really didn't have a lot to base my actions on. Then over time, you gain experience and you can get a lot more comfortable once you learn to speak the language, so to speak.
Bee venom is good for you, you say?
Oh, yeah. There's a field called apitherapy. It's really good for arthritis, some nerve issues, MS. A lot of people use it for MS. Wow. It's like acupuncture with a bang.
I guess so. So do you actually get it applied by the bees?
Yeah, you can hold the bee, so it's almost like an acupuncture needle, and then there's certain spots where it might be counterintuitive to sting. Kind of like acupuncture, they sting you here and there for other things. So you can find pressure points or pain points and actually use the bee venom right in a very point-specific.
Okay. That might have been something we would have gotten at the end of the hour. So I want to come back to the process of what you do right now then. When you talk about, for example, going down to bring the bees to California to pollinate almond trees in February, what's the process of prepping? What do you have to do to make this trip with the bees?
Well, preparation for that actually starts right now. During this time of the year, we're really following through with monitoring colony health and nutrition. And the bees that are in the eggs and larva pupa stage right now have to be really healthy, because those are the bees that are going to raise the offspring that will form your winter cluster. So nutrition and a low pest load has to occur at this time of the year, because we go from a bee that lives probably 3 weeks during the active summer foraging season to be able to produce a bee that lives 3 months long. So we ask a lot of these winter bees.
Okay, so they have to live a lot longer than bees normally would live?
Yeah, to form the winter cluster and keep the brood area warm and the queen safe, yeah, it takes a long time. So
some very detailed work. We'll find out more about it. John Jacob is the president of Southern Oregon Beekeepers. We're talking about what bees do and what people do to help bees do what they do. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll give you the phone numbers and the email address again. After the break, back with John Jacob and your phone calls and emails on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. You're back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We are talking today about the care and feeding of bees and all the things that human beings do to help bees do what they do as pollinators and living, working creatures out there in the world. John Jacob is the president of Southern Oregon Beekeepers and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. I see he's presenting an intermediate class on beekeeping this weekend. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. You can join us on the exchange to ask your questions, make your comments, observations, questions you might have always had about bees. Here's the place to put them out there. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Go to our Facebook page, and you can see John from the picture here in the studio just a few moments ago, and join us there as well. So, John, the intermediate class you're giving, is it you giving it this weekend?
It'll be me, and our guest speaker is a gentleman by the name of Lincoln Mettler, who's been a beekeeper since the 70s. He's coming down from Seattle to help teach.
You mentioned having no mentors when you first got started. Has that changed over the years? Did you finally hook up with some people who had some experience and could show you some ropes you didn't know existed?
After I reinvented the wheel several times, we definitely start, as the operation got bigger, you start to work with other commercial guys and you can watch what they do and learn from them. And I would encourage anybody that wants to make a career in beekeeping, save a lot of trouble and work for another more experienced beekeeper for at least a year or two.
How long did you do it on your own?
5 or 6 years. It was the hard way, but it worked out well. I tend to learn well from books and hands-on, so I could muddle through maybe a little better than some folks could.
So we were talking just before the break about the growth of bees and how long they live. And so you said some of the summer bees live about 3 weeks, and the ones that are going to be doing pollinating next winter, early spring, are bees that need to live for several months?
Well, it's the winter cluster bees. They hunker down anytime starting in, by late October, the cluster's starting to get tighter and the brood rearing is curtailed. And so from November, December, January, those are the 3 months that the winter cluster has to really stay alive and in contact. And then they start to rear the bees that'll have that flight experience. It's that working, that pollinating, the foraging that wears them out. That's why their lifespans are shorter. There is also a nutrition component there too. But essentially, the summer bees and spring bees that do the pollination work wear themselves out and have a shorter life expectancy.
I know I keep talking about going back to square one here, but one of the notes I wrote down after I'd come up with the list of questions yesterday was bumblebees versus honeybees. Which are which? Who does what?
Well, bumblebees are excellent pollinators on a bee-to-bee basis. They actually pollinate a lot more flowers than honeybees do. The advantage honeybees have is that they're highly portable and they can make up for it in sheer numbers. But a lot of the problems that we see in our pollinator population, it's not just CCD and honeybees. There's a lot of pressure on all of our native bees right now. So it's kind of part and parcel of the conditions out there for all pollinators right now.
I know when we talk about CCD, we're talking about colony collapse disorder, but this is one of the major ones. I should point out that the major bee die-off in Wilsonville last year was actually caused by an insecticide, one of the neonicotinoids, which there's lots of pressure now to ban. Colony collapse disorder, though, tell us about what knowledge we have up to date about that, because it seems like it's been mysterious every so often. They figure out maybe it's a fungus, maybe it's mites, maybe it's a combination of fungus and mites. I'm never quite sure where things stand with the investigations into colony collapse disorder.
Well, it's a highly charged issue. There's a lot of finger pointing going on. It's a myriad of various different things, in my opinion. You know, you could think of the straw that breaks the camel's back. You know, you could blame that last straw, but it's the environment in general out there. You know, large scale monocultures, the way we farm in Big Egg, doesn't leave a lot of forage for the native pollinators. That's why they have to pay us to bring bees in to set their crop, because the land cannot sustain enough of a native pollinator population to get the crop set so they can make their food.
I hadn't thought about that before. I mean, the fact is you guys wouldn't need to be traveling around the country with truckloads of bees if the bees were abundant in the neighborhoods of the farms where the bees are needed for pollination.
It's true, but we would have to have a complete redo of our modern farming system. You know, it's kind of chemical intensive, large scale monocultures, and it does not leave a lot for honeybees or other pollinators left behind. So, and the other thing is, we have this trend of, you know, everybody likes lawns. Well, lawns are a pollinator desert. They don't really feed anything, you know, people or pollinators. You know, if we were real thoughtful about how we landscaped and used water and resources a little more wisely, we could support a substantially larger pollinator population.
John Jacobs, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the president of Southern Oregon Beekeepers Association. When you talk about lawns and landscape, though, I mean, most people's reaction to bees is still like, a bee, which probably really cracks you up.
It does. You know, once you get to know them, honeybees are my specialty, but I know a lot of other pollinators. And in general, their stinging instinct is for nest defense. So if they're out foraging, that's neutral territory. There's no incentive for them to defend neutral territory. Usually away from the hive type stinging episodes happens when someone has, you know, inadvertently stepped on one or something. You know, yellow jackets can be a little more aggressive, but in general, most of the pollinators have a live and let live type approach, unless you're disturbing their nest, and then they will become defensive.
All right, but still be careful. If you're running your hands through the lavender or something, make sure you don't take a bee along with you.
Sure, or if you have clover to mow and stuff, you know, do it at the right time of the day. Do it real early or real late when the pollinators are all in.
All right, so that brings us back to the question of lawns and landscaping. You mentioned that lawns are like a pollinator desert. So if you wanted to put some landscaping out there that encouraged bees to set up shop in the neighborhood, what kind of landscaping would you put out?
Well, I would plant stuff. Well, in this area, definitely we want to be drought-tolerant type plantings, but you want to be very strategic in that you pick stuff that will bloom very early in the season, stuff, you know, early spring. That really helps give the pollinators a boost. And then we have a pretty decent spring flow from April, May, and June. Then stuff that starts to bloom in June and beyond is really good, because we have a summer dearth, and it takes a toll on the honeybees' nutrition. And then stuff that blooms really late. So there's hundreds of species you could pick to plant from, but try to use a mix. You know, you want some annuals, some perennials, and trees and shrubs. So, you know, you can build your pollinator landscape over time. And they're very aesthetically pleasing. Who doesn't like lots of flowers? And they're often easier to take care of than a lawn, and can require substantially less inputs in terms of fertilizers, pesticides, fungicides, and whatnot.
How much moisture do bees need around in plants, or just in the environment generally? I mean, there are obviously several species native to Southern Oregon, as dry as it is during the warm season. But how much water do they need?
Well, they need a daily water requirement to just cool the hive. They use evaporative cooling. They gather water and spread it around the hive and fan. But more importantly, the big water requirement is to support the wildflowers. And most bee forage comes from wildflowers. And if it's a dry year, they're not as productive in pollen or nectar. So in extremely dry areas, it's a little more difficult to support larger pollinator populations.
Have you had particular issues with your own bee colonies? Have there been issues with some of your bees dying off? Have you run into problems like that?
There's been ups and downs over the years, and you know, we do some things a little different than a lot of beekeepers do. We're breeding for disease tolerance, specifically varroa mites, but all bee diseases in general. So we often will withhold certain treatments from our group of breeder queens that we're screening for certain traits, and we'll let the mite numbers build, and that will cause you to lose some hives. But it also helps me to be able to determine which ones have the best mite-fighting behaviors, you know, like hygienic behavior and grooming and stuff like that. So you can take some hits here and there. In general, beekeepers can plan on large-scale operations often lose 30%, sometimes more, sometimes less every year.
Well, so there's going to be a fair amount of bees that do die off one way or the other. The whole process of breeding queens, this is fascinating. I mean, queens, do they start life as something else? Or is it like a subspecies within a species of bee? Or?
Every queen is 100%. Let me rephrase that. Worker bees and queens come from a fertilized egg, period. The only thing that changes them is the diet they receive while they're developing. So when we grow a queen bee, I select a larva that's 12 hours old or less, and it hasn't differentiated down the worker bee pathway yet. And then I give those larvas to hives that are primed to rear queens. There's two instincts that we can tickle to make the bees want to rear queens. One is the natural swarm impulse, and the other is the emergency or supersedure impulse, where if they detect a lack of queen pheromone, they will start trying to raise their own queens from young larvae. So I try to stimulate both those instincts, and then I give them the queen cells from our desired breeder stock, and then they make queens from those for us.
John Jacob, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the president of Southern Oregon Beekeepers Association. We're talking about bees, pollinators, and all the things they do and all the things that humans do to support them and some of the challenges that bees face. Obviously, they are many in today's world. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your questions and comments, 800-838-3760. Anywhere you can hear us, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So nothing genetically says queen. It's just you get fed this and you become a queen.
Yeah, it causes the organism to go down a different developmental pathway. So if you were to select a larva that were too old, you get what's called an intercast. It'll be half queen, half worker, and they're kind of problematic because they're harder to find and they could cause you all sorts of troubles. They won't make a good hive.
So what is the diet then for the queens? What makes them queen?
It's the royal jelly.
I love hearing this story, but go ahead.
Well, the royal jelly they receive initially, you know, it changes in composition depending on the age of the larva. And for the first 3 days, it's identical. So if we collect the larva before they start feeding it worker bee jelly and they feed it queen bee jelly is the trick. And then the other thing we have to do is it's usually one queen per hive. So you have to gather the queen cells before they hatch. Otherwise, they'll be melee and you could see one queen cell where you were supposed to see 40 or 60.
So you really do have to do a lot of manipulation here. This is a lot of intervention on the part of you, the human, to make sure that you get what you're looking for in queen development.
Queen rearing is very intensive. That's part of the reason why not a lot of beekeepers rear their own queens. Some people do it to a small scale, but for the larger commercial operations that are pollinating our food supply, most of those guys will buy queens because it is extremely labor intensive and time intensive. And even with the best laid plans, you know, Mother Nature will deal you a flood or a drought or, you know, it's a real challenge, but it's very satisfying. I really enjoy it.
Sounds like you're really working against the clock here. I mean, if you mentioned having to work within the first 12 hours, wasn't it?
Yeah. So you definitely you're working on bee time. You know, you forget your watch and just set yourself to bee time only.
So are you saying then that you know, of a group of eggs, then they could all be queens or they could all be workers, depending on what they're fed?
Exactly.
Wow. And so is there any determination? Do you have any way of knowing, just by looking at an egg or by weighing it or anything, that this is going to be a better egg to turn into a queen?
Well, we have certain hives that we've been screening for traits, for these disease tolerance traits that I was talking about earlier. One of them is a hygienic behavior. And so, you know, before I go to make these queens, I've had the breeder hive around for at least a year or two. We've tested it for the hygienic behavior trait. It's maintaining low pest loads on its own. So in general, most of those queens should be very similar to their mother. I mean, honeybee genetics is quite complicated because the males are haplodiploid. That means they come from an unfertilized egg, so they're 100% related to their mother, and it creates some interesting dilemmas. And plus, they mate on the wing miles from the hive, so controlling honeybee genetics is an extreme challenge.
So there's not a lot of genetic diversity within a hive, then, you're saying?
Well, their mating system is set up to cause extreme genetic diversity. Their propensity to mate with, you know, 20 or more males miles from the hive, And the queens and the drones, they have different flight radiuses for their mating flights, so it causes them to not mate with their own drones, like her sons, which were 100% related to her. So that would cause inbreeding depression, which is very bad for honeybees. They actually have a tendency to be extremely diverse in their genetics. I mean, there are problems with our breeding pool in general that it's gotten kind of small over the last, 40 or 50 years, but the USDA has done a lot to bring in some new genetics. But controlling honeybee to get a purebred queen is an extreme challenge.
Sounds like. John Jacob, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, president of the Southern Oregon Beekeepers Association. We're talking about bees, beekeeping, and the whole process of assisting pollinators in what they do. So how successful so far? I mean, are you able to, are you enough generations along now that you can see what kinds of results you're getting from selective breeding and trying to breed hardiness into the bees?
Oh, absolutely. Like this hygienic behavior test that I keep referring to, when we first started doing that, we had very few get 100%. We freeze 130 queen cells with liquid nitrogen. And then once it's thawed, we put it back into our screening hives and, start our watch, and we time how long it takes them to clean it out. And we have a lot of our bees getting it in 24 hours now, whereas probably 10 years ago it would be less than 10%. So you can see these traits build up over time, and there's other traits that you can see build up over time too. That being said, you do identify occasionally a bulletproof queen, and when you make 100 daughters off her, you'll get a bell-shaped curve. On one extreme, they'll be exactly like her. There'll be a lot in the middle that have some of the traits or carrying the traits but not expressing them. And then there's always that other tail end of the curve where you wonder where they came from. I know it's the queen that I raised off the breeder, but, being highly hybridized, you get some strange combinations popping up here and there.
So I'm trying to think in terms of generations. Are we talking, 15, 20 generations of bees a year potentially?
Well, a brood cycle from egg to adult is 21 days. So by the time we stick a new queen in a hive, it'll take at least 21 days for her workers to start showing up. So by the time, it'll probably take 2 brood cycles for her to really push out the other queen's genetics, and then you could start to see the new queen's traits start to come to fruition.
We have an email here from Bill, no town given. He's referring back to our discussion of bee venom. And he says, in small amounts, one sting, bee venom is suspected of halting the development of arthritis or perhaps having other medicinal properties. And as a result of receiving a few stings distributed over a long period of time, a beekeeper eventually loses sensitivity to the venom. The stings still hurt, but do not produce swelling, and an experienced beekeeper can tolerate numerous stings without harm. But an ordinary person will die from 300 stings, and a very few people will die from one sting. Inexperienced people should simply not invite bee stings, writes Bill. Square with your knowledge?
Yes, it does. And I would always say, before you undertake anything like that, I would talk to your doctor and know your sensitivity levels. The people who do that professionally, they do test stings and they take a look at a person's medical background and make sure it's safe. Because if you did happen to have an allergy, one sting could be enough to be a huge problem.
And how much have you gotten stung over the years? I imagine it's something that still happens to you on a fairly regular basis because you are working. You just mentioned hive defense, and so if you're working around the hives, you're going to get stung.
Yeah, well, we're in the hives. It's too much. Honestly, I quit counting years ago. A lot. Let's just say a lot. When you're in bees all day, every day, nearly, it's bound to happen. And when we work with the queens, we work barehanded. That being said, in an average work day, looking in, sometimes hundreds of hives, unless you're doing something unusual, I might only get stung 6 or 12 times. But, it becomes a part of the background. You just forget about it.
The royal jelly that the queens get fed that make them queens, where does that come from?
It's secreted from a gland, and that brings us back to the nutrition factor. Bees make all their protein comes from pollen. So this is where we get back to planting for pollinators and, how we're providing nutrition for our pollinators. It takes a lot of pollen for the bees to be able to secrete copious amounts of that royal jelly. And it's not just for the queens. The worker bees get a different type, but it's all derived from pollen and it's all secreted from worker bee glands.
All right. More about making life better for bees because they make life better for us. Back with John Jacob, the president of Southern Oregon Beekeepers, with your phone calls and emails on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about bees, pollinators, and all the things that humans can do to help out them do what they do. Our guest is John Jacob, who is the president of the Southern Oregon Beekeepers Association. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. We did mention earlier there's an intermediate class coming up this weekend. You're one of the teachers, I guess. This is Saturday. Where, when, and do you have to have taken the earlier class, the beginner class on beekeeping, to attend this intermediate class?
There's no requirement to have taken the other class. You know, even if this is your first year, you know, this is more about the more technical part of getting your bees ready for winter. And I would encourage even total beginners to come and experienced people. Lincoln Mettler, who's going to be doing the brunt of the talk, is an amazing beekeeper, and he's seen it all since the 70s. So he knows a lot about preparing for winter and multiple queen systems and stuff like that.
And where is this going to be and when?
It's going to be at the OSU Extension Center. I believe
on
it's
Hanley Road?
On Hanley Road, mm-hmm. Near Jacksonville. I believe it's from 10 to 4. I don't have the flyer right in front of me, but it is on the Southern Oregon Beekeepers website, and there is a registration form there, and you can register right from the website and pay online.
All right. OSU Extension, Saturday, 10 to 4, Saturday the 16th. How many people are getting involved in beekeeping in Southern Oregon? I mean, you were just telling me before we came back from the break that there's been a bit of a boost in interest in bees.
Well, like that honeybee disaster up north on the linden trees with the neonics, CCD in general has brought a lot of awareness to beekeeping. I mean, honeybees are kind of the canary in the coal mine. They're a great indicator species of what's going on in the environment. And people have really taken it to heart, and it's generated a lot of interest in beekeeping. We've seen, you know, when I first started running the bee club, we would maybe have a dozen people show up, and now 50 people would be a small gathering. I mean, it's not uncommon to see 50 to 75 people at our monthly meetings. And the amount of hobby backyard beekeepers in the Rogue Valley is astounding. I mean, we sell 300 or 400 starter hives a year, and probably 80% of those are in the Rogue Valley every year.
Given how upset some people do get about bees, and in the case of people who are allergic, it's completely understandable. Are there any restrictions, any city codes and things that might say, no, you can't put a hive in the backyard?
It really varies wildly from municipality to municipality. I know Ashland allows beekeeping with some certain conditions. Central Point does not. I don't know about Medford. You know, the thing is, there's always a lot of native or feral colonies, whether they're honeybees or other types of bees. And I think in a culture where we have more beekeepers around, when there are swarms, whether they come from a managed hive or an unmanaged hive, if you have a lot of people in the area who know how to safely deal with them, I think everybody's going to be better off as a whole, pollinators and people.
The hives always look to me like a chest of drawers. What actually is it like on the inside?
There's typically a wooden or plastic frame that holds what's called a piece of foundation. It could be an embossed piece of plastic that's coated in wax or just straight beeswax. And some people actually are starting to do foundationless frames, but that's what the bees draw their wax out on. They say draw. That means they secrete it's converted from carbohydrates that the wax is, and they make a hexagonal pattern that they use to store their honey and rear their brood in.
So you just mentioned a few minutes ago that all the bee protein comes from pollen. So, I mean, they secrete a lot of stuff from their bodies. I mean, just about everything they do and make, it just comes from within them. So they need a fair amount of fuel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For fuel in general, I always think of the carbohydrate, the nectar, the honey. That's the go juice, and then the protein and the fats, the plant lipids and whatnot all come from the pollen sources. So it's an average hive can go through, you know, up to 80 kilograms of pollen a year. So that's a lot.
Yeah, wow, that is a lot. Let's go to Pam in Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to John Jacob from Southern Oregon Beekeepers Association.
Hi, well, I've been studying this and working with the Oregon Sustainable Beekeepers up here in the Eugene area, and I was actually reading last night in the science journal Nature that they have found that the neonicotinoids are also hurting the bird populations. And one of the things I have found out in the last couple of years is that half. So a lot of people are aware that the bees are having the colony collapse disorder, and it's a variety of reasons. One major reason is these pests, these neonicotinoids. And one of the things a lot of people don't know, and I just found out pretty recent as a person who's been involved, is that half of all the plants you buy in the big box stores have the neonics in the plants and the soils and the seeds themselves. So you think you're buying this great pollinator plant that's going to help the pollinators, and you could actually be hurting them. So when in doubt, buy organic plants, but also ask the nurseries or wherever you're getting your plants if they know, because it's another way to educate them and get the word out. Because I know a lot of people are starting to have their small hives and trying to help in the neighborhoods. And another thing that one of the groups are doing in Eugene is they're going out into their, when they get their beehives, they go out into their neighborhoods and ask their neighbors to take a pledge to not have the to not spray the neonicotinoids, and to also not buy the plants with the neonicotinoids in them, because they're systemic and they all throughout the plant. Just buyer beware, and it's really important. There's two islands in Scotland that have just designated small islands as pollinator islands, totally for the pollinators, which is pretty cool. So,
all right,
it's a little advice for people that want to help these help our pollinators out, that they make sure they get organic or there's no neonics in the plants or the soils.
Okay, great. Thanks for sharing that with us, Pam. Good to hear from you. Is that square with anything that's going on in the Rogue Valley? Similar moves?
Yeah, I think I heard recently one of the big Home Depot, I think it was, they changed suppliers to avoid the neonics in the treated plants. And that's a very good point. You know, demand plants that haven't been treated with neonics. They are very effective as a pesticide, but they cause a lot of unintended consequences because the material can be secreted in the pollen and the nectar. And when those materials got their approval, they were looking for, you know, acute lethal effects, and it turns out that there's a lot of sublethal effects that just create a drag on pollinator health, you know, immune system-wise over time, and they didn't really look at those long-term effects when they approved those materials.
Let's go to Melly in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Jacob from Southern Oregon Beekeepers.
Hi, this is Marilee. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I have a question. What is the possibility? When I was a little girl, I spent time on a bee farm that was in my family. It was C.F. Conanson, which are down by Hamilton City, somewhere in the area between Chico and Willows on the old road along the Sacramento River. And my aunt, who was my grandmother's husband's wife, and they were the Conans. She would take me down in the basement of their home, and somehow she was making something that was somewhat of a sugary syrup thing, and they do sell the queens. They've been there since 1907, and so they've been there for over 100 years making queens. But I think she was actually doing something to make the royal jelly in her basement. And how would she have done that without it being done naturally by the bees themselves? That's my question.
All right, good question, Marilee. Thanks for that. Appreciate it.
I would wager they were probably mixing some pollen substitute. It's a protein source that you can give your bees, and it does result in those glands that it helps stimulate the glands that produce the royal jelly. There's a huge nutrition component. I know I keep coming back to that, so we actually, when we're preparing for pollination now and to rear these important winter bees, we like to be putting, especially in a dry year, some protein sources in there so that they can produce that royal jelly and produce a longer-lived bee.
So in a sense, you're doing the training table for athletes before you get them ready for the big game.
Sure, and you know, with habitat loss in a drought area, you know, it becomes more incumbent upon the beekeeper to be a good shepherd and really make sure the nutrition needs of that hive are being met. You know, where we get a little worried where there's unmanaged populations, you know, they just take a hit in tough years.
Sure. You mentioned the hobby hives, and I was wondering how much work do you have to put in if you want to have just a hive in the backyard just to kind of help out. You know, you need to do some nice plantings and stuff. But I mean, how often do you have to tend them? How much intervention do you have to do if you're just a hobby beekeeper?
Well, I think that's part of the popularity is that, you know, it'll take you a little while to get your legs under you. But, you know, I would say on average allocate 10 minutes per hive once every 10 days. Now, truthfully, it may be a little bit more than that during the active season and a lot less than that during the inactive season. You know, it's more about doing the right things at the right time. And, you know, unless there's a problem, you know, during the winter season, you hardly get in your hive at all. I mean, you want to let them be, so to speak. A lot of people love their bees to death because they're in there all the time messing with them. And, you know, they thermoregulate that hive at a specific temperature and humidity. So every time we open it, it creates a little challenge for them. So I encourage people to spend as little time in there as possible and just do what needs to be done and nothing else.
All right, let's go to Jesse in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Jacob, the beekeeper. Jesse, go ahead.
I'm a member. Hi, thanks for having me. I'm a member of SOBA also, and I just wanted to let everybody know I've been working with the Medford Plant Commission and the mayor on legalizing hobby-scale beekeeping. We'll be having our first public hearing in about a month and a half. I encourage everyone that wants to support that to come and show up or to go ahead and call the mayor now or call John Adams and let him know.
So the public hearing not yet scheduled, you say?
No, it's about a month and a half out. That's the last heading I got. I've done the work with the Planning Commission. We have a ordinance drawn up. Now we just need to present it to the populace and see what everybody wants to say about it.
Okay, and any idea if that'll be an evening or an afternoon hearing?
No, Mr. Adams has not scheduled that yet.
Okay, so just keep checking.
All I know is it's 4 to 6 weeks out. That's all you can tell me right now. But just wanted to put it on everybody's radar.
All right, appreciate that. Thanks, Jesse. Good to hear from you. Let's go to Peter in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Jacob.
Hi. I was wondering about, first of all, what examples of neonic pesticides or whatever they are, and then also whether or not with the prevalence of pesticide use around the country, around the world maybe, whether or not in the honey, if it is ever or always slightly contaminated.
All right, so neonicotinoid examples and contamination of honey. Thanks for that, Peter.
I know that large-scale honey packers do have their honey tested. I'm not sure about the smaller scale. Most of the crops that are intensively using those are the ones that we get paid to pollinate, and almost never do you make or take any honey from those hives. So most of the honey is gathered from wildflowers typically. You know, the pollinated crops are so early in the year, the bees use all that nectar and honey themselves to grow more bees to get ready for the main flow, we call it, which around here is usually blackberry season, vetch. Those are the two big wildflowers that most of the honey crops made on, and those are not treated, of course. Well, hopefully. I mean, some people do spray those with certain things.
Right, but so what are the examples of neonicotinoids? And they're called neonicotinoids because they mimic tobacco, is that right?
Yeah. Tobacco can be a nerve toxin for insects, and it's fairly tolerated well by humans. But I'm trying to think of brand names. You know, Bayer makes a lot of products that contain them. There's names like clothianidine.
Dinotefuran is one of them, isn't
that's,
it?
That's another one. Imidacloprid is another big one. If you do a little search on it, you could probably get all the name variations. They all are tongue twisters and a mouthful to say, but you got to become a label reader and just look for those.
All right. Let's go to Phyllis in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking bees with John Jacob.
Hi, thank you. What is the role of yellow jackets in the scheme of things, and what's their relationship to those bees that we think of, you know, in a very positive way, you know, being pollinators?
So, yeah, what do yellow jackets do, in other words?
What do they do? I think that everything that lives has some beneficial thing that they do. most of us have a hard time identifying what it is that the yellow jackets actually do. And are they big competitors to the those that we do consider, you know, pollinators and obviously beneficials?
All right. Thanks for that, Phyllis. Appreciate it. Yellow jackets. I've been had a few run-ins with them myself. What do they do?
Oh, me too. Well, they're great scavengers. You know, they are sort of bottom feeders. I've watched them just for fun. This might sound gross, but I've watched them pick a mouse carcass clean down to the bare bones, and it was just yellow jackets on it in about 12 hours.
Wow.
So, I mean, there's a purpose there. There's some incidental pollination. They do kind of pick on the weaker hives. I've noticed, you know, if you see yellow jackets picking on a particular hive, that's probably a hive that's under duress. So, you know, it could indicate to you that you need to go in there and see what's going on.
All right. So they do have a beneficial purpose.
And I'm sure there's others. I mean,
mm-hmm. All right. Well, we've certainly gotten a lesson here today in beekeeping and what goes on with beekeepers. And obviously we have a link to the Southern Oregon Beekeepers Association, of which John Jacob is president, on our website and our Facebook page as well. John, thanks for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Good to have you.